the judges for the award are very serious people who understand sport and think very care very deeply about it. It's the primary sports award. And so if it says this is the book of the year, that's a very big statement. When you're awarded with an award like that, I wanted to cry. I did cry, I think. I mean, I'm almost trying thinking about it now.
Hey, welcome back to the William Hill Sports Book of the Year 2020 podcast. The voice you just heard was one of our previous winners, Peter Oborne. He won back in 2004 for his book about Basil D'Oliveira, Cricket and Controversy. Well worth digging out, that one. So we are on to the second of our five shortlisted books for this year's prize. Just a reminder before we get started that you can go back and listen to last week's episode, which was our interview with Roxana Begum and Sarah Shepherd for their book Born Fighter. A lot of people have been in contact saying they were really moved by Roxana's story. I heartily recommend listening to that if you get the chance. And also, of course, hit subscribe, and that'll make sure you won't miss any of our future episodes. So let's get on to the second of our five shortlisted books for this year's prize, and that is The World Beneath Their Feet by the American author Scott Ellsworth. This tells the story of the British, the Americans, the Nazis, and the mountaineering race to summit the Himalayas. While tension steadily rose between European giants in the 1930s, a different kind of battle was raging across the Himalayas. Contingents from the great powers had each set up rival camps at the base of the mountains, all hoping to become recognized as the fastest, strongest, and bravest climbers in the world. Fueled by deep national needs, the great Himalayan race captured the attention of the world. British superiority, German innovation, American determination, and the wonder of the Sherpas dominated the newsreels, radio broadcasts, books, and magazines of the age. Let's hear my interview with Scott Ellsworth. I'll let you into a secret here, Scott. This book was one of the front runners from the start, in that for probably the first couple of months, I would, if someone had asked me to put a bet on, I'd have said, this book's going to win it, because it was one that all of the judges loved to begin with. And I think the reason for that is that it is a story that none of us knew anything about. So let's assume that the people listening to this podcast and watching you now haven't read the book. Let's assume that they don't know the story either. Tell us this amazing story about the race to conquer Everest.
Well, first, I'd just like to thank you for having my couple of glory months there early. And I am completely honored, seriously, and humbled to be, you know, have made this short list. The other books are just terrific. So The World Beneath Their Feet is about a really a lost and a forgotten story that I was fortunate enough to stumble upon. And what happened is, during the 1930s in particular, there was a race between mountaineers from Great Britain, from Germany, and the United States. Some other nations are involved as well, too, to see which nation's climbers could be the first to climb to the top of one of the world's great peaks in the Himalayas, specifically a mountain that was 8,000 meters high. And there are only 14 of them in the world, and not one had ever been climbed to the top. And these are, you know, Mount Everest and K2 and Nanga Parbat and mountains like that. And I just lucked upon it one day. I had published a book in 2015 about the history of basketball, and I was looking, which had taken like 20 years to do, and I was looking for a new book. And searching around on the internet, and I saw a photograph of German climbers who were Nazis on top of a peak in the Himalayas with a swastika flag. And I was just mesmerized, you know, from the beginning. And maybe 2 hours later, I finally emerged, you know, from the computer. I've now found out a little bit about the British climbers of the era. I found out about Americans. I've heard about the Italians and the Poles and the French. And I said, my God, nobody's done this. And, you know, what appealed to me were a couple things. First of all, I'm the child of World War II veterans. The war was something that, you know, every teacher, coach, Boy Scout leader, you name it. They were all vets, so I grew up knowing about this. I grew up with older aunts and uncles who had survived the Depression. My mother had actually worked for an Arctic explorer, and she had met, and during the war in New York City, she had met some of the top mountain climbers of the era. And then I had done some climbing as well. And from about the time I'm 19 until my early 40s, this was nothing special, I'd please tell everyone. But, you know, I'd climbed in the Cascades. I'd been on an expedition in Alaska. I knew what a carabiner was. I knew about, you know, being on an expedition and having some familiarity with it. And I thought this was, you know, this was stuff I had enough experience that I thought I could tackle.
I'm interested in what you think the motivations of those three. So if we've got three groups that were looking to scale Everest, we've got the Brits, we've got the Americans, and we've got the Nazis as well, of course. I've got my own sense as to what I think the motivations were for those three groups. But I'm interested in your take on it, Scott. What do you think was motivating those three different groups to try to be the first to get to the top of Everest?
Well, and there's going to be some, you know, details and whatnot with it. But basically, it boils down to this. Look, the British invented mountaineering. It is a British sport. Yes, there were people who climbed mountains other places, but the Brits are the ones who really developed the modern techniques in the 19th century. They're the first one to, you know, create, you know, specific climbing rope using ice axes and stuff like that. And the history of mountaineering for the first, you know, 100 years is really, it's the Brits are all over the place. So they are out to climb the greatest mountain in the world, which is Mount Everest. I mean, they're happy to do other things as well, but that's the big ticket. And they feel that they've earned this mountain, they've earned the right to do it, and they're the best they are. The Germans are coming from a whole other place. There were great German climbers. But after the defeat in World War I, there was just a great bitterness in Germany, feeling that they were treated poorly by the Allied nations afterwards, having to pay reparations, all of this stuff. And there was a sense that, you know, there was a British climber by the name of Paul, or German climber by the name of Paul Bauer, and he talks about, I put down my rifle and picked up my ice axe. And for him, mountain climbing and success ultimately in the Himalayas was a way to, you know, win glory for Germany, win back their rightful place in the body of nations. But there was something else too that was going on. The British climbers were tradition bound. You do certain things in certain way, you know, that's the way we've always done it, that's the way we're going to do it. The Germans weren't that way at all. They were into innovations. They were happy to try new materials, new techniques. They're happy to try something new. So, you know, kind of the modern piton, you know, the spike that climbers will, you know, pound into the rock walls and clip onto, that comes from Germany. The carabiner is a German thing as well, too. They're also not about individual glory. They're about team glory. So they start to become just terrific climbers, but they're out there for national pride. And then you've got the Americans. And the Americans, American climbing had mainly been, you know, part of the Northeast of the United States, well-to-do, upper-class, you know, Harvard and Yale students who are enthralled of how Oxford and Cambridge students behave. They want to dress like them. They want to act like them. So they start climbing in the Northeast and following the British ways of doing things. But as they start to go west in search of bigger mountains, first in the Rocky Mountains, then in Canada and Alaska, they're getting to these huge peaks, but they've got a problem. And that's because the European expeditions to the Himalayas, you'd hired 100, 200, 300, you know, porters, local people to carry your gear. There's nobody for the Americans to hire in the middle of Alaska. There's nobody there. So they realize they've got to do it themselves. And so to be able to do that, they create this new lightweight, move fast, move small, hardly carry anything form of climbing. And it's all about self-reliance. And at first, they're not very good. But this new way has got promise, and they start to make waves.
I think a trait of great books is always when there is tension, even though you already know the outcome. And I think that's what's in your book is, you know, any school child in Britain knows that Edmund Hillary gets to the top of Everest first. And so we all know that. And yet I'm reading your book and it's reading like a thriller. I'm just along for the ride. Was there anything, and obviously you will have known the history of Everest before you embarked on this book. Was there anything whilst you were digging into this story that you were surprised by?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's too many things to say. I was just blown away by these guys. I mean, you know, again, you know, right now we have this horrid image of climbers queued up on Everest, all these, you know, vice presidents of, you know, investment firms and stuff like that. And it's no big deal to spend, you know, £100,000 to show up there. And they've got all their fancy gear and all this stuff. That is the complete opposite of these climbers from the 1930s for the most part. They don't have much money. They've got to figure out how to do things, and they're learning along the way. I mean, I just love Eric Shipton. You know, I mean, in some ways, he's the, if not the hero of the book, but one of the heroes. Here is this kind of dyslexic screw-up who, you know, can barely get through public school, you know, by a miracle gets into Cambridge, but turns it down because he's discovered climbing. All he wants to do is climb, and he's a magnificent mountaineer. But he also realizes that these great big expeditions that the British are doing just aren't going to work. And so he just wings off with another guy. They were going to ride their bikes from London to India because they didn't have enough money for steamship fare, even on some tramp steamer, to get to India, and they just show up. They find ways of living off the land, and I'm just blown away. I mean, these people, they don't have any maps. They don't have any photographs. They're wearing cotton parkas. They have leather boots. Their stoves don't work. Their people are getting sick off the food, and they come within 1,000 feet of climbing it. And everything else, you know, they don't have all these training, you know, climbing gyms and all this stuff. They're smoking cigarettes. They're drinking brandy. You know, they're hauling books, you know, to the top, you know, as close to the tops of these mountains. And I just love their spirit and their elan. And they're just an incredible group of people. I fell in love with them.
Yeah, one of the other judges made the point on an earlier podcast to say you could go to your sort of, you know, regular mountaineering shop with £100, walk out with better equipment than these guys had when they went up Everest, which is just astonishing. I'll tell you that there is one, there's a small part of the book which I loved, which was it's a great little tale about the Times, the length that the Times newspaper went to make sure that they had the exclusive that Hillary had got to the top. And they'd come up, or the reporter had come up with a code. And because he knew he was going to have to send a Sherpa down with the message, but he didn't want, if anyone intercepted what was in that message, he couldn't obviously say, Edmund Hillary's got to the top of Everest. So he would have to come up with a code. And he knew that if that code said, you know, the quick brown fox, blah, 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 you know, land in Moscow.
The apples were delivered.
Absolutely. He knew if it's that, then people go, oh, that definitely means he got to the top. So just tell us a little bit about that code, because I had enormous fun reading
it. Well, you know, again, he had to figure out, you know, what he could do and you know, how this is going to work. And so he would have, you know, things like weather postponed, and that meant, you know, a Tom Bordelon or a certain climber, you know, things aren't working out the way that they want. You know, we'd come up with all these different codes to do it, but then he had to get a Sherpa to carry it down. I mean, he has this story. It's all going to work. It's going to be marvelous and all this. He's, you know, the Times reporter, and he gets down there, and then he runs into the reporter from Reuters who has climbed up to base camp, and the Reuters reporters go, well, how are things going? Oh, pretty good. Well, where are you going? Oh, I just thought I'd take a break for a while. And it's this little dance they play. And then, of course, he sends this, it's James Morris, who later becomes Jan Morris, and James Morris for the Times. And then he sends his message, And then the Indian telegraph officer decides to sort of change it and make it more grammatically correct. But luckily, he didn't screw it up so much that it got through. But no, that just killed me. I just love that story.
I love the fact that it's almost completely scuppered by a telegraph officer deciding to sub down the copy, which is obviously the bane of any journalist's life. I love the book. And as I say, particularly because it was telling a story I'd never heard before, a great achievement, Scott. I'm interested whether you've got a favourite sports book that you sort of recommend to people. Do you have a favourite?
No, I do. I've thought a lot about that. And of course, you know, the sporting world in the United States and the sporting world in the UK is a little different. So, I mean, there are some great books about baseball and football that I love. But and there's obviously going to be a literature in England I don't know everything about. But I would say the book that really does it to me was, is Laura Hillebrand's Seabiscuit, which was, you know, a winner before. You know, and you know, you and I get this, and I think most of your listeners get it. We understand sports is very important to us. It's a part of our life. It's a part of our soul. It you know, it gives us spirit. It gives us hope. But what she does is she takes an everyday reader into this world of horse racing, and now we can see the human drama. Now it's all there. I mean, this could be a book about war. It could be a book about politics. But it's all there, and I just think she just did a magnificent job. And I'd recommend Seabiscuit to anyone.
Absolutely, and as you say, it's a former winner of this prize. It's a great book. Yours is also a fabulous book, Scott. I'm really happy you could come on the podcast. I wish you all the luck. But when you've got a book as good as that, maybe you don't need the luck. But it's a very strong shortlist this year. But your book absolutely deserves its place there. Many congratulations on getting this far, and many thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks. I'm honored to be here. I really am. Thanks so much.
That's Scott Ellsworth. The World Beneath Their Feet is the title of the book. An extraordinary story. And really, we only scrape the surface in that interview there. I think both of us deserve a prize, by the way, for not talking about the US elections in this week of all weeks. So well done us there. Let's now hear from one of our judges, six judges involved in deciding what's going to win the William Hill Sports Book of the Year this year. And our next judge is a former footballer. He also was chairman of the Players Union, the PFA. He was also the first footballer on Question Time. His autobiography, You Don't Know Me But A Footballer's Life, came out in 2013, and I'd really recommend reading it. It's one of my favourite football autobiographies. He is, of course, Clark Carlisle. First question then, Clark. What is your go-to book? When people ask you about sport books and they're thinking of picking one up, they're not sure, what is your go-to recommendation? You go, right, start with this, number one.
The sport book that I would frequently recommend, even if people aren't interested in the sport, is Gary Nelson's Left Foot Forward. It's an incredible book. It's fantastic. It covers so many topics and aspects within the book that there is something that will resonate with every reader. You know, it teaches you far more about the game of football than you could ever know from being on the outside, or even, you know, when you're close on the periphery. There are a lot of journalists who won't have the insights that are available from that book, and you won't put it down. Let me tell you, you'll finish it in a day or two tops.
Absolutely. I'm a huge fan of that book. I'll tell you, I've not read it in, God, it must be 20, 25 years. But I'll tell you the sequence that I always think about when I think about that book. And that is that Gary was the PFA rep for... So he played at Charlton, as you know, and he was the PFA rep. And he's giving a chat to some of the up-and-coming players. So these are lads who perhaps haven't got into the first team yet, but they're on their way. And he's basically saying to them, as the PFA rep, look, vast majority of you in this room will not make it to the first team. And you need to be thinking about what you're going to do if you don't make it. And he basically, what he says is, I could see every single one of them looking back at me with a look that said, you can tell the rest of these lads this, but I'm making it into the first team. He says, every single one of them was looking back at me and saying, yeah, whatever, lad. Rest of them can hear this chat. I don't need it.
I'm making the first team.
It's so true as well, Matt. Every time a PFA rep or someone who comes in to talk to the young aspirationals about an alternative option, no danger, you know? And the sad fact is that mentality is actually necessary to make it. You know, you need that blinkered perspective, that obsessive compulsion to be better than the next person. But when there's only, 1% of these guys who'll still be in the game at 21, that means that 99% of them have done it to the detriment of their future lives and careers. And it's so hard to get that to them. You know, it really is. And I experienced that firsthand as PFA chair myself. So, yeah, there's a lot of really good insight in that book.
It's a great book. I love it. Can you remember the first sport book that hit you, Clark, that just sort of, you know, square between the eyes hit you that you loved?
Definitely, without doubt, and I still have it. Robert L. Fish, it's his biography of Pelé, My Life and the Beautiful Game. Oh, my goodness. My dad got it me in hardback for my 8th birthday, and I must have also got a set of multicoloured pencils because I wrote in there, this book belongs to Clark James Carlyle, given to him by his father, on his and I signed it and everything. But that book, let me tell you, it's more than just the story of, in my opinion, the world's greatest footballer. It's a story of overcoming obstacles and poverty and playing your first game of professional football in barefoot, you know, things like that. It was a great inspiration for me to come from a council estate in Preston and see this guy who came from, you know, the favelas in Brazil to be the world's greatest footballer. Awesome.
Do you you've been a judge on the William Hill Prize for a number of years. Do you have a favourite previous winner from either when you were a judge or even before then? A favourite previous winner of this prize?
I really liked Killian Jornet's book. I thought that was absolutely incredible. There was so much in that book that resonated with me. Not that I've ever been an extreme runner, you know, or tried to do the Ultra Trail de Mont Blanc, but similar to the loneliness of the long distance runner, you know, when you do go on these long fitness exercises that really take you to the edge of your physical capacity, your brain goes west. It's incredible what your brain can go through. And, you know, it's almost out of body at times that your brain can take you to another place and also haphazard, you know. So one part of it might be dreaming of records and you're like, yeah, I'm going to do this in this time. And then all of a sudden you're a superhero who's flying over here. And, oh, can you imagine if I won the lottery? You know, the brain is an incredible thing. And the way that Killian Jornet puts that in his book, again, you know, arguably one of the greatest ultra runners of all time, yet his book's not about I did this, I did that, I won this, I won that. You know, it's really inside his brain as he's on this physical experience.
Yeah, absolutely. That Killian Jornet book is a great book. And again, I'm the same as you. I'm not a massive runner. Well, you know, I do a bit of running, but I'm nothing like that at all. But I love, and you're absolutely right when you say that books like that, where and it seems to be in cycling and in running, where they're talking about what is going on in their heads as they're doing this. Basically, it's a repetitive thing. You're just one foot, next foot, one foot, next foot. And cycling, the same thing. You're just doing a very repetitive thing. So the brain is going to all these different places. You're absolutely right. What do you look for when you're judging this prize, Clark? Is there an X factor? Is there something that you're looking for in these books when you're picking a winner?
Well, I'll tell you, it's actually evolving year on year, because I remember when I first sat, first two, 3 years I sat as a judge, and I would hear, you know, the likes of John and Graham and Hugh, God rest his soul, talk about this book in comparison to another book 10 years ago. And I'd be apoplectic. I'd be, no, you can't do that. You know, we're not comparing it against a book from 10 years ago. We're comparing it against these 5 books here today. But and over those first few years, I would always look for a book that that kept the pages turning. That I look for that in any book, whether it's a sports book or not. You know, you can't put it down. But especially something that teaches me something new, you know, about a sport or a discipline or a mindset that I hadn't come across before. So that's usually what I'm looking for. I know there are some people who prefer literary pieces, you know, some want something well-researched. I just want to learn something new. You know, take me to a new experience and one that I want to continue down the road with you.
Absolutely. I think that that's been a real strength of the prize in the last few years, I think. There's been, I'm thinking in particular of Barbarian's Life?
Barbarian Days, yeah.
Yeah, Barbarian Days, correct, that's it. Where he's talking about surfing, and I don't know the first thing about surfing, but I loved that book. It's such, yeah.
It was outstanding, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it was a literary piece, I think, yeah, Barbarian Days. Yeah. It was a very, very new style of Sports Book of the Year winner, and I absolutely adored it.
So if we were to come to your house then, Clark, and look through your bookcase, would there be a... And we were looking just at the sport books. Would there be a theme there? Would there be like one sport that would dominate more than any others, or one that features more than any other?
Well, there is, and it surprised me. It's actually boxing. So, you know, books about boxing, I seem to be intrigued by them, you know. And it's not just that I've purchased a lot, but I'll tell you what gives a good insight into my likes is the books that stay on the bookcase after each year of judging. Because, you know, we get through some 50, 60, 70 books, and there are a lot that are in the garage, I'm not going to lie to you. You know, so the ones that actually stay on the bookcase, I had a look through, and boxing features heavily, a lot more than I thought. But if I was to not look and just tell you what I think is on my bookcase, it's usually the stories that resonate. And they're not sport specific. They're invariably stories of trauma and redemption. You know, that kind of cycle, trauma, redemption, and hopefully paying that forward. But yeah, I think that's the kind of cycle that stays on my bookshelf because it resonates with my life story. You know, you always enjoy a book when you see a piece of yourself in there, you know, when you really empathise with it and you feel where it's taking you. So, yeah, I think that's the cycle that's in my books.
I think you're right. I think it's interesting because I'm not a massive boxing fan, but I've got a huge amount of boxing books upstairs. And I think as well, I would make an argument, and this is completely unscientific, but I would argue that the two sports that produce more great literature, more great sport books than any other, are boxing and cycling. And I've found those two particular sports to be so fruitful as far as great writing's concerned. And if I'm honest, I'm not a huge fan. You know, I'll follow the Tour de France and, you know, I know a little bit about boxing and things like that. But it just seems to be that that books about those two sports just produce great books again and again and again.
Definitely. I totally agree.
Yeah. Is there a sports writer that you always pick up? Regardless, they could be writing about their shopping list, it doesn't matter. Is there one that you will just go to every time, Clark?
I mentioned him earlier, actually, the late, great Hugh McAvenny, you know, whether it was an opinion piece, an article, or some of his fine literature. He's just such an eloquent and passionate writer and really persuasive for a man who can be quite belligerent. You know, when you're sat in a judging session with him and sometimes you just want to poke him in the eye and, you know, he just has this way with words. He articulates things in a wonderful way and the depth of perspective that he's given on so many different sports and disciplines and even, you know, politics and social sciences. He had a wonderful way about him, did you? And it was a privilege to serve on this panel with him.
No, he is much missed, and his writing for me is the gold standard. Whenever you sometimes see those quotes on the backs of books or on the front of books, and they'll reference this book, the new Hugh McIlvenny, and I think you need to be very careful about saying that, because
that is
very, very high praise.
I hope you enjoyed those. These episodes are weekly until the winner of the William Hill Sports Book of the Year 2020 is announced in December. So make sure you don't miss any of our future episodes by hitting subscribe on your device. That way, future episodes will just drop onto your phone. You won't need to do a thing. If you could leave us a review, that would be very kind and much appreciated. And even tell your friends, that'd be great as well. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.